Now, what a couple hours we've got for you as we talk about encounters with flying humanoids, monsters of Texas, flying monsters, what's going on in Alaska, all kinds of things with cryptids, with our special guest Ken Gerhard back on Coast to Coast, and I'm going to dive right into it with him when we come right back. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Ken Gerhard's with us. Ken is widely recognized as a cryptozoologist, field investigator for the Center for Fortean Zoology, and a Gulf Coast Bigfoot research organization as well. And he has been interested in mysterious animals, legendary beasts all around the planet, Bigfoot, Loch Ness Monster, Chupacabras, winged creatures, werewolves as well. He's written several books, including Encounters with Flying Humanoids, Monsters of Texas, and Big Bird. And here he is back on Coast to Coast. Been a while, but Ken, it's good to have you with us. How are you?
I'm doing great, George. As always, it's an honor to be on here with you tonight.
What have you been over the last couple of years? You've still been doing a lot of research with these cryptids, haven't you?
I feel very blessed. I've had a lot of really cool and amazing opportunities to investigate a whole variety of mysterious creatures. And most recently, I am co-hosting a new series on a History Channel called Missing in Alaska.
Yep.
And we're actually up there in the state of Alaska investigating some of these fabulous creatures, among other things.
Kind of reminds me a little bit of that movie, The Fourth Kind. What do you think?
Yeah, it's kind of the same premise. You know, what's really fascinating, and I didn't really know this, George, is how many people actually do go missing in Alaska. Per capita, it has twice as many missing persons cases as the second closest state. For example, since 1988, there have been, I think, more than 53,000 missing person cases. And in 2007, a statewide clearance house listed 2,300 missing person cases just for that year. So it varies, but on average, we have, you know, anywhere from 500 to a few thousand cases of missing people in Alaska, which is pretty remarkable when you consider that the entire state only boasts a population of about 600,000 people. So that's about 4 in every 1,000 people that go missing without a trace.
That's huge. And theories about this, Ken, what do you think? What do they come up with?
Well, of course, you have to acknowledge the obvious, George, which is, you know, Alaska is a very foreboding place, as I learned myself. 600,000 square miles of pretty intense wilderness area. You know, there's obviously dangerous animals and all kinds of reasons that people might die of hypothermia, get lost in the wilderness, and so forth. So, you know, you certainly have to take that into consideration. But what I didn't know is that Alaska does boast a number of just fabulous legends that relate to all manner of really strange and somewhat menacing creatures, some of those that we investigate in the field of cryptozoology, and all of those are acknowledged in the different native legends up there. You know, you have different, 4 different major native groups, the Athabascans, the Yupiks, the Inuits, and so forth, and they all have legends of these kind of horrible creatures. So we investigated some of those. And in addition to that, Alaska apparently also has a lot of UFO activity. I'm sure you've probably heard that here on your show. But a lot of UFO sightings up there as well, and I guess that kind of ties into the fourth kind a little bit. You know, so there are all kinds of foreboding mysteries, kind of befitting of the great state of Alaska.
Does Alaska, Ken, have its own Bermuda Triangle?
It does. It's known as the Alaska Triangle. And it's a large swath of land that ranges all the way from the very northern part of the state in Barrow, which is right up there in the Arctic Circle, all the way down, cutting through the city of Anchorage and all the way down to Juneau. And it is an actual triangle. You can find some pretty cool diagrams of it online and so forth. And it is within this triangle area that most of these disappearances have occurred. So very similar to the Bermuda Triangle in that respect.
Have people picked up any strange readings in this triangle? Any kind of vortexes? Anything like that?
Well, that's, you know, one of the first episodes we investigated the vortex theory. There are, in addition to missing people cases, there are actually some cases of missing aircraft. And we're not talking about just small float planes here, George. I mean, there's a famous case from 1950 where a military craft with 44 people aboard went missing, completely vanished.
Wow.
The last transmission was over the town of Snag, Yukon, right after it had passed over the border from Alaska. And despite an intensive search that included like 300 military planes, hundreds of personnel, and it spanned 39 days, they, to this day, and we're talking, you know, 65 years later, they've still not found a trace of this pretty sizable aircraft. And that's just one example. There are other cases on record.
That's bizarre.
In the early 70s, in 1972, I believe, the Speaker of the House of Representatives, Hale Boggs, was in a private plane, and he disappeared along with State Senator Nick Begich and the pilot. And same thing. They did an intensive search. They used the stealth spy, whatever their version of the stealth spy planes, I guess, that they had in the early 70s. And, they still never found any sign of that plane either. So, you know, the theory comes up that perhaps if you buy into the theory that there are these vortexes, and vortices, I guess, would be the proper plural for that. Ivan Sanderson, the great Freudian researcher, had this theory that there were actually a series of a dozen vortices, what he called vile vortices, all over the world, including the Bermuda Triangle and 11 others that actually lined up in different lines of latitude and longitude. And these particular areas, window areas, had increased numbers of disappearances of, you know, people, aircraft, ships, and so forth. You certainly have to recognize the possibility, you know, if you look at hyperspatial, hyperdimensional realities, that there are these perhaps vortexes or windows, portals, whatever you want to call them. And, and perhaps that is how these people are disappearing.
Ruling out, let's say, alien craft abducting people, and we'll get into that, of course, or taking craft. These vortexes that could be there, these energy forces that are like the Bermuda Triangle,
mm-hmm.
How do you think, if they exist, Ken, how do they work? How do they function?
Well, I think the best theory is that it has to do with electromagnetic, geomagnetic anomalies. Of course, the Earth itself is a giant magnet. You know that it's you have the magnetized poles, you have the molten core, and it essentially acts as a giant magnet. But you have magnetic fields all over the planet, and you know the magnetic fields affect everything, particularly life forces. You know, we have, for example, many animal species use these magnetic fields in order to navigate and travel thousands of miles. We as humans have a minute amount of magnetic matter within our bodies. So magnetic energy really is kind of the life force of this planet anyways. So the theory is that we explore in this particular episode is that, you know, you have these vortex areas that are somehow tied into these magnetic anomalies, and that occasionally these vortexes, for whatever reason, will actually open up, and that these massive amounts of magnetic energy will pass through. And, the obvious thing you have to say, you know, they would cause equipment to malfunction. If you were flying a plane, for example, you could imagine your compass going haywire and other things like that that would possibly cause you to crash. But, you know, a more, I think, dubious and nefarious possibility is that these vortexes are wormholes to other dimensions, to other realities in our hyperdimensional universe, and that this magnetic energy works as kind of a propulsion system that sucks things out of this world and to God knows where.
Got you. That's true. And so craft or planes or ships or even people that may stumble into this wormhole or vortex, they get sucked into it. And now let's assume they're someplace else. They're in another dimension, another world. I mean, my gosh, could they be alive now, just wandering around?
pretty scary stuff to consider. Now, admittedly, George, I'm not a quantum physicist, so I learned quite a bit about this particular theory. But you know, Einstein did prove that the string theory is possible, that the universe is somehow connected with these string-like objects, not just standard matter, but these string-like particles that essentially vibrate and resonate and connect in ways that are far beyond our comprehension and understanding. So theoretically, we could be surrounded by other dimensions of reality that we're not able to perceive due to limitations in our neural hardware. In other words, the world that we do perceive is essentially, you know, the environment that we're immersed in is constructed by our mind in a way that our mind can function and understand it. But that doesn't mean that there can't be other dimensions all around us, you know.
All right, so that's one possibility, the vortex, the portal, the wormhole. Let's talk about these UFO sightings in that area, Ken, because there are a lot of them. So is it possible people are being abducted by extraterrestrials?
Well, you know, that's a great segue, George, because, you know, one theory holds that if we are in fact being visited by extraterrestrial intelligences, that perhaps they're using these actual vortexes or wormholes to get here from wherever they're from. That said, Alaska does have a high concentration of UFO activity. Apparently the American military took quite an interest in that. You know, I just mentioned the case of the missing C-54 aircraft back in 1950, where there are allegations and rumors that just weeks before that craft disappeared, that there were sightings of UFOs over Elmendorf Air Force Base, where that particular plane took off from. But moreover, going into recent times, there's a very famous craft I'm sure you've talked about on your show, the November 1986. There was a Japanese Airlines Flight 1628. This was a cargo 747 loaded with wine and headed from France to Japan. And as it flew over Alaska, they actually, the pilots discerned three objects that subsequently chased their craft, according to them. One of the craft that they spotted, they claimed was twice as big as an aircraft carrier. And this encounter was corroborated from the ground by radar workers down there at Elmendorf Base. So, you know, that's one particular case. There was allegedly a kind of a cover-up when this radar information was analyzed by different government agencies, and they kind of swept it under the rug. But this may have been the first real definitive radar evidence that our government, our military, had of an actual UFO. But, you know, that's just one example. Within weeks after that incident, there were other UFO sightings around Alaska. And, you know, up until just last year, we were up at a location, Mount Hayes, which is up in Denali National Park, where there have been a lot of UFO sightings, allegations of an underground UFO base there under Mount Hayes that date back to the 70s. And there was a pretty notable UFO sighting just weeks before we arrived up there.
And in these particular cases, Ken, these people are gone. They're not brought back. They're not still here, right?
That's true. There are thousands of people that have never been found. Now, there are some people, I think some of the cases probably have been solved through the years, but a good portion, a percentage of those cases are unsolved. And we got a kind of a firsthand taste of that ourselves when we were up there filming in the city of Juneau. There was actually a tourist that went missing the week that we were up there, and there was a massive manhunt that ensued. So it's an amazing proposition that so many people vanish up there without a trace and are never found.
We're with researcher and author Ken Gerhardt, of course, who is also doing a series on the History Channel called Missing in Alaska. How did you folks all hone in on Alaska, Ken?
Well, what's kind of interesting, George, is that one of my castmates, his name is Tommy Joseph, and he's a Tlingit. He's a Native American Tlingit. Mm-hmm. His father actually is a missing person. When he was a young boy, his father went out on a fishing trip in a boat by himself and never returned.
Oh, boy.
So Tommy's kind of grown up with that. And so, you know, it was a, kind of a tragic story. But he was driven to sort of look into some of these other missing persons cases to see if he could find some answers, find some closure. And subsequently, he, I guess, got in touch with a production company that was working with the History Channel, and they were looking for other investigators to kind of help them out. And I was one person they reached out to, in addition to another guy, Jack Zatwell, who's a private investigator. And he kind of more of a skeptic, so he was going to kind of bring his law enforcement background. And, of course, I'm more of a cryptozoologist, but I've always been fascinated with other anomalous phenomena. So the three of us joined forces. And that was kind of how the show was conceived.
Ken, in the movie The Fourth Kind, of course, they talk a lot about Nome, Alaska for these disappearances. Is Nome, Alaska in this triangle?
Nome is not in the triangle.
Not in the triangle.
No, okay. It's on the far western side of the state. And unfortunately, we did not have an opportunity to visit Nome. That was one of the places we were attempting to investigate. But we stayed primarily in the within the boundaries of what is known as the Alaska Triangle.
Well, I've seen this movie twice. I still can't figure out if it's Hollywood or if these are real stories. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know either. I think it's one of those things. They certainly made it look like kind of a found footage kind of documentary. But, you know, I have heard allegations that perhaps some of that was sensationalized.
Yeah.
So I really don't know.
Now, there have been a number of Bigfoot cases in that region as well in Alaska. Now,
yep.
We don't hear a lot of stories of Bigfoot abducting people, taking them away, but what do you hear out there, Ken?
Well, as we investigated Alaska's version of Bigfoot, which is known locally by a number of native names, Arulatak, Urayuli, Ikutika, Gilyuk, and so forth, but all of those translated mean basically hairy man or bush man. So essentially the legends speak of a hairy man-like figure, a giant hairy man-like figure, very similar to the North American Bigfoot or Sasquatch. And as we did our investigations, what we found is there actually have been claims that Bigfoot-type creatures have abducted humans on occasion, particularly up in the far Pacific Northwest. Now, one example of that is a young lady in Rampart, Alaska, back in the 1980s, claimed that she was actually kidnapped by one of these Bigfoot creatures, these Bushmen, and that she was taken back to a cave where this thing was essentially living or dwelling with other Bigfoot-type creatures, and that she was held there captive for a number of days before she managed to escape. And she felt that she had been brought there in order to care for one of their infants, which appeared to her to be sort of sickly, and she got the impression that they felt that somehow she would be able to help this juvenile creature. That's just one example. There's a very famous story throughout Alaska that's known from an area called Thomas Bay, which is on the far southeastern part of the triangle. And from a book that's kind of well-known in Alaska called The Strangest Story Ever Told, back in 1900, a number of prospectors went out to this area to do some prospecting, and they had some encounters with these, what they referred to as hairy devils, which, if you read the descriptions, it sounds like kind of a Bigfoot creature spot on. And in fact, they were chased out of this area, they claimed, by these highly aggressive, hairy man-like creatures. So, those are some of the Alaskan stories. And then you have, in the bigger part of Bigfoot lore, you have the famous abduction of a man named Albert Ostman, who was a Swedish prospector who claimed that he was abducted by a family of Sasquatches back in 1924. This is very well known in the Bigfoot field. So you do find these stories, these accounts of people being kidnapped or abducted by Bigfoot.
Let's talk a little bit more, Ken, about this Bigfoot, because I want you to describe for us what it looks like. We'll be back in a moment. Ken Gerhard with us. All his information linked up at coasttocoastam.com. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. We're talking with Ken Gerhard. His television program is called Missing in Alaska. It's on the History Channel. talking about these various things we're talking about right now, specifically around the Alaska Triangle. And we've talked about extraterrestrials, a vortex. Now we're talking about Bigfoot. How have people, Ken, described Bigfoot in Alaska?
Well, George, that's, as an investigator, one of the most compelling things to me is that descriptions of Bigfoot or Sasquatch or, you know, Yeti over in Asia, mm-hmm. Abominable Snowman, they're all very, very similar, very consistent. That's very compelling to me as a researcher. But in Alaska specifically, they describe Bigfoot or hairy man as standing about 7 to 8 feet tall, very broad and muscular, completely covered in hair from head to foot, very broad shoulders, no neck, leaving footprints about 15 to 16 inches long. So it kind of fits the archetype of the traditional Sasquatch or Bigfoot that is reported in Washington State, California, and elsewhere. But one interesting tidbit we picked up on, and I was fortunate to hook up with Alaska's preeminent expert on Bigfoot, a man named J. Robert Alley, and he's collected a number of sightings from the state of Alaska and actually told me that he has some descriptions that actually characterize these creatures as standing anywhere from 12 to 15 feet tall.
Wow.
Which is, so I was pretty blown away by that. Now, you don't really hear about that here in the lower 48.
No, not at all.
Descriptions of Bigfoot or Sasquatch that big, and it's really hard to kind of wrap your mind around that something, a hominid form, could stand 12 to 15 feet tall, but there are apparently, you know, multiple descriptions that state that they're literally that big, or some of them are that big.
That would be eerie to see, Ken, I think. I could handle a 7-foot Bigfoot, but man, you see one 15 feet tall, that's eerie.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, a lot of cryptozoology is based on mythology and folklore. So when you hear these descriptions of man-like creatures that stand 15 feet tall, well, the obvious thing is to look at the worldwide mythology and folklore, and obviously you have these enduring legends of giants. I mean, let's be real, that's what they call them, giants dating back, you know, hundreds or thousands of years in different cultures all over the world.
So let's put Bigfoot aside as another possibility. There are other legendary creatures that you've looked at. There's a strange one that I'm not too familiar with, a shapeshifter called Kushtaka. What is that?
Yes, the Kushtaka. The Kushtaka is a Tlingit legend. I mentioned my friend Tommy earlier. He's Tlingit. That's kind of the southeastern part of Alaska. The Kushtaka is known as the land otter man. And according to the Tlingit people, this Kushtaka is a shapeshifter that essentially lives deep in the wilderness. It bears the characteristics, physical characteristics of both humans and otters, which are, you know, very common animals in Alaska. There are two species of otters. There are, of course, marine otters, and then you have the land or the river otters. But according to Tlingit legends, these Kushtakas, they're very conniving, and ultimately what they're trying to do is to lure people out into the wilderness and essentially to assimilate them by getting people lost in the wilderness or causing people to drown or die, to, you know, various deaths out in these wilderness areas. And if that were to happen to you as a Tlingit warrior or brave, for example, then you would become a Kushtaka. So essentially, it's an ongoing cycle where these shape-shifting creatures will essentially lure unsuspecting humans out into the wilderness and then assimilate them and turn them into Kushtakas themselves. Now, one of the really creepy aspects of this legend is that these Kushtaka creatures will sort of trick you by taking the form or the shape of somebody that is familiar to you. For example, a friend or a relative, and that is one of the ways that they will lure you into the wilderness. Another part of the legend states that they will make a sound like a baby crying.
Hmm.
Well, what's your instinct as a person if you're out in the woods and you hear a baby crying? Well, you would think, well, you know, there's a baby in distress.
That's right.
Maybe I need to go.
Something happened to the parents. You got to find the kid.
Find the kid, and then that's the Kushtaka luring you out into the wilderness. And my castmate Tommy claims that he actually did encounter one of these Kushtaka creatures at one point in his town of Sitka, Alaska, and that he said that this thing looked very much like an otter, except that it had kind of a strange look in its eyes, almost like it was possessed or something. and that he ultimately, against his better judgment, he did begin to follow this thing kind of out into the woods.
Wow.
It seemed to be leading him away from his home, and then he kind of came to at one point and realized what was going on and was able to sort of break the spell. But many of the Tlingit people that I spoke to, they were very adamant that this is not a myth, this is not a fable. These Kushtika creatures are very, very real to them.
That's creepy, that this creature is creepy.
Yeah, it's pretty creepy. And, you know, just a little sidebar here. A few years ago, Charlie Sheen actually, I guess it was kind of more of a publicity stunt than anything else, but he staged a Kushtika expedition of his own up in the state of Alaska.
Huh. So. It wasn't too successful with that, was
it? No, I guess not, no.
You've looked at Thunderbirds. These creatures are intriguing to me because they could be prehistoric, but whatever they are, we get sightings of huge birds as big as Cessnas. What do we hear in Alaska?
Yeah, well, as you know, George, I've been investigating the Thunderbird phenomenon for many, many years now. I have collected accounts, eyewitness accounts from all over North America. But Alaska, despite its very small population, definitely seems to be a very active area, a real hot spot for these Thunderbird accounts. Now, of course, you have to acknowledge that you have the many native Thunderbird legends. And in fact, if you go to Alaska, you'll actually see Thunderbirds being portrayed on different totems and native artwork and so forth. So the belief in Thunderbirds in different native cultures there dates back many centuries. But in terms of modern sightings, back in 2002, there were a number of sightings of Thunderbirds over Alaska. It actually made international news because many of the eyewitnesses were experienced pilots and so forth that saw this enormous bird that had like a 14-foot wingspan, basically the size of a small airplane. And through the years, and partially in thanks to you for having me on Coast to Coast in prior years to talk about Thunderbirds, I've had people reach out to me from the state of Alaska that have also seen these Thunderbirds, and they describe them as essentially looking like giant raptor types of birds, very much like an eagle with a hooked beak, kind of a predatory bird, dark-colored feathers. But again, the thing that really stands out is we're talking about a wingspan that ranges anywhere from 15 to 20 or 25 feet across, which is about five times bigger than any known bird species. So we really could be dealing with, I believe, something prehistoric in nature. If you go back and look at the Ice Age, the Pleistocene epoch, 10, 12,000 years ago, North America actually was populated by these enormous birds known as pterotaurs, and they did have wingspans anywhere from 12 to 18 feet across, and they were somewhat related to modern condors and vultures, so they may have had that kind of raptor-like appearance. So what we could be dealing with here is a surviving population, perhaps a very small population of these enormous prehistoric birds, and what better place for these birds to remain hidden than in the great state of Alaska.
You know, I'll always remember this incredible story, and I believe it was an Illinois kin of the woman who came outside to see a bird with its talons stuck into its her son, a little boy, and it was lifting him up, and she had to knock him down with a broom.
Yep, absolutely. That's the Lawndale incident. You've nailed it. July 25th, 1977. 10-year-old Marlon Lowe was picked up by one of two giant black birds right in front of his mother and several other eyewitnesses, carried for several feet until they were able to basically convince this bird to let go of him. And there are other accounts in history, George, of giant Thunderbird-type creatures carrying away small children, for example. I don't know of any documented cases of them carrying away adults. But theoretically, if you're talking about a bird with a 25-foot wingspan that weighed perhaps a couple hundred pounds or more, then, you know, it is a possibility. So that is something that we explored for this particular episode, that perhaps some of these missing people in Alaska, God forbid, may be carried away by these giant Thunderbirds to some remote craggy peak.
And fed to baby birds or something.
It's hard to envision, isn't it? But definitely a chill is running down my spine right now.
Oh, my God.
About it.
How big do you think the eggs would be? 12 inches tall? 2 feet tall? How big?
They'd be big eggs. I mean, you got to imagine an ostrich egg, and maybe several times larger than that. If you've ever seen an ostrich egg, they're pretty big. So, you know, but that is one of the, from a skeptical point of view, that is one of the frustrating things, is we don't have any physical evidence of these thunderbirds. No one has found a giant egg or a giant nest or anything yet. But that certainly doesn't preclude the possibility that they exist, because I've interviewed, as I've said, many dozens of people, very credible people from all walks of life, who have testified that they've seen these things, and I believe them.
So this is all geared back to people disappearing in Alaska. So are we talking about all of the above, one or two? Which theory do you think might be the one?
Well, each episode we explore a different theory. And, you know, what was really remarkable is that as we delved into each legend, each theory, each possibility, the reality of them, you know, kind of slapped us in the face. You know, it's one thing when you're sitting there and you're reading an outline and thinking, oh, is this really possible? Are people being abducted by Bigfoot or Sasquatch? Are they being carried away by Thunderbirds? But if you're asking me my opinion, George, I would think that, you know, the possibility of UFO abduction, even though that's not one of my areas of expertise, it's a pretty chilling proposition. And certainly if our planet is being visited by other intelligences, and for whatever reason they are abducting human beings to commit these diabolical experiments or whatever, you know, we would be completely helpless to stop that.
I think we would too. It really would be frightening. There's nothing you can do, Ken, to stop something like this.
Yeah, and again, going back to Alaska, I mean, because of the remoteness of some of these villages and communities in Alaska, you know, there's not a really good system of working roads there. A lot of people that are living in coastal areas have to get around by boat. You know, a lot of people fly in small airplanes and so forth. But theoretically, if extraterrestrials were abducting humans, it would make sense that they would go to a place like Alaska, where they could perhaps operate under a veil of secrecy.
Let's talk about one of your books, Encounters with Flying Humanoids. What the heck could they be?
Well, flying humanoids, as the name implies, it's a creature that combines the characteristics of a human with wings and essentially flies and is airborne. The most famous of these, of course, is Mothman. The Mothman of West Virginia, which is kind of become an iconic creature. I had the great honor and pleasure of being up at the Mothman Festival in Point Pleasant, West Virginia, earlier this year, or last year, I should say. And, you know, Mothman is this strange creature that's been reported by hundreds of eyewitnesses, standing about 6.5 feet tall, bat-like wings, sturdy man-like legs, and the most shocking and chilling feature of the Mothman are these giant red hypnotic eyes. Everyone says that, you know, all the eyewitnesses claim that this creature has these giant red glowing eyes, and certainly doesn't sound like anything of this earth. But my book, Encounters with Flying Humanoids, kind of chronicles the Mothman history. But in addition to that, I kind of took a global look at similar creatures around the world, and I found that there are, in fact, creatures like the Mothman that have been reported from every continent, from different cultures all over the world, and that these descriptions literally date back thousands of years. If you look at the ancient Sumerians and the Assyrians and some of these really old cultures, they actually have depictions and portrayals of these flying humanoid types of creatures in their artwork and so forth. So as far as what they are, I would merely be speculating, George, but I certainly don't think that they were, I don't think that they evolved on this planet as natural living creatures. I think that we're probably dealing with something interdimensional or spectral in nature.
You even have tossed gargoyles into this batch, haven't you?
Yes, I did. I did a chapter on gargoyles. I wanted the book to encompass some of these other weird flying creatures, like the Jersey Devil, of course, which is very well known, urban American legend. I have collected accounts of seemingly gargoyle-like creatures, not humanoid in nature. Almost some people have described them as looking like kind of bat-like creatures, I guess, bat-like wings and more animalistic type of characteristics as opposed to human. Some people have described them as looking like flying dogs or griffins from Greek mythology. So the description is varied to some extent, but they, again, we're not talking about a bird, we're not talking about a giant bat here. We're definitely talking about something that combines characteristics from different animals and, you know, winged creatures as well.
Of all the creatures you've investigated, Ken, from Alaska to Texas to all the places you've been, which is the one creature that still baffles you the most?
Wow, that's tough. I mean, they're the field of cryptozoology is actually pretty darn vast.
It's wide open, isn't it?
Yeah, people often talk about Bigfoot and the Loch Ness Monster and so forth. I guess I've done a lot of investigations into the chupacabra, which, of course, is this vampire-like creature that's been reported from Latin America. And, in fact, last year I traveled down to Mexico to the state of Puebla, where there had been literally hundreds of goats killed by some unseen predator in one night. We're talking about an entire pen of goats, about 100 goats eviscerated in one night. And the according to the livestock owners, I didn't get to examine the bodies, unfortunately, because this happened back in 2010. But according to the livestock owners or ranchers that I interviewed, these goats were essentially rendered bloodless. They were completely exsanguinated of all their blood. And the only telltale sign left behind were two puncture wounds in the neck. So in essence, you're talking about a modern-day vampire, if you will. And the descriptions of the chupacabra vary, but in Mexico they describe it often as looking kind of like a reptilian type of creature, similar to Mothman in that it has these glowing red eyes, very sharp teeth, of course, and fangs and claws. But in some cases, they also describe it as kind of being a winged creature as well, almost like a giant vampire bat.
Jeez. There is so much on this planet, Ken, that we just don't understand or have full knowledge of yet. So much. But with these creatures, either everybody's lying or they're all telling the truth. And that is what keeps me pushing and driving and investigating as you do. Because I think people are experiencing something. I think they're seeing something that they cannot explain. There are things out there.
Yeah, and, you know, skeptics will often counter that eyewitness testimony, for example, is not tangible physical evidence. It's anecdotal evidence, which is true in some respects. But when you look at the consistency of the descriptions from people that are seemingly unrelated, you know, it becomes very compelling when you have these kind of consistent themes and motifs popping up from different eyewitnesses that have encountered these things. And I've got to tell you, George, I've interviewed many people, and I'm always very skeptical going in, particularly if the story doesn't ring true right off the bat. But when you look in someone's eyes, you can actually see the emotional impact
yep.
these experiences.
You are absolutely right, Ken. Stay with us. We're going to come back with a final hour to go with Ken Gerhardt, and we're going to take phone calls as well about all these creatures that we've been talking about.